bending image, but it had not. If anything, the angle of the camera revealed the act more clearly than she'd witnessed it. She turned the playback off. She called A.G. "Is there anything we can do?" she asked. Within minutes, she was on the phone with Bailey himself. She was glad to get him because she knew that if anyone would agree with her on this, it would be Bailey, a man of unerring moral compass. He didn't want a sex act like that broadcast around the world, did he? Well, that had already been done, but surely they could erase a few seconds so the image wouldn't be searchable, wouldn't be made permanent. "May, come on," he said. "You know we can't do that. What would transparency be if we could delete anything we felt was embarrassing in some way? You know we don't delete." His voice was empathetic and fatherly, and May knew she would abide by whatever he said. He knew best, could see miles further than May or anyone else, and this was evident in his preternatural calm. "For this experiment, May, and the circle as a whole to work, it has to be absolute. It has to be pure and complete. And I know this episode will be painful for a few days, but trust me, very soon nothing like this will be the least bit interesting to anyone. When everything is known, everything acceptable will be accepted. So for the time being, we need to be strong. You need to be a role model here. You need to stay the course." May drove back to the circle, determined that when she got back to campus, she would stay there. She'd had enough of the chaos of her family, of Mercer, her wretched hometown. She hadn't even asked her parents about the sea change cameras, had she? Home was madness. On campus, all was familiar. On campus, there was no friction. She didn't need to explain herself or the future of the world to the circlers who implicitly understood her and the planet and the way it had to be and soon would be. Increasingly, she found it difficult to be off campus anyway. There were homeless people, and there were the attendant and assaulting smells, and there were machines that didn't work, and floors and seats that had not been cleaned, and there was everywhere the chaos of an orderless world. The circle was helping to improve it, she knew, and so many of these things were being addressed. Homelessness could be helped or fixed, she knew, once the gamification of shelter allotment and public housing in general was complete. They were working on this in the NARA period. But in the meantime, it was increasingly troubling to be amid the madness outside the gates of the circle. Walking through San Francisco or Oakland or San Jose or any city, really, seemed more and more like a third-world experience, with unnecessary filth and unnecessary strife and unnecessary errors and inefficiencies. On any city block, 1,000 problems correctable through simple enough algorithms and the application of available technology and willing members of the digital community. She left her camera on. She made the drive in less than 2 hours, and it was only midnight when she arrived. She was wired from the trip, from her nerves on constant alert, and needed relaxation and distraction. She went to CE, knowing there she could be useful, and that there her efforts would be appreciated, immediately and demonstrably. She entered the building, looking briefly up at the slow-turning Calder, and rose through the elevator, breezed across the catwalk, and to her old station. At her desk, she saw a pair of messages from her parents. They were still awake, and they were despondent. They were outraged. May tried to send them the positive zings she'd seen, messages that celebrated that an older couple, dealing with MS no less, could still be sexually active. But they weren't interested. "Please stop," they asked.
"Please, no more."
And they, like Mercer, insisted that she cease to contact them, unless privately. She tried to explain to them that they were on the wrong side of history, but they weren't listening. May knew that eventually she'd convince them that it was only a matter of time for them and for everyone, even Mercer. He and her parents had been late to get PCs, late to buy a cell phone, late to everything. It was comical, and it was sad, and it served no purpose to put off the undeniable present, the unavoidable future. So she would wait. In the meantime, she opened the chute. There were few people with pressing needs at that hour, but there were always unanswered queries waiting for business hours to start, so she figured she could chip away at the load before the newbies came in. Maybe she'd finish them all, stun everyone, let them come in with a clean slate, an empty chute. There were 188 latent queries. She'd do what she could do. A customer in Twin Falls wanted a rundown of all the other businesses visited by customers who had visited his. May found the information easily and sent it to him, and instantly she felt calmer. The next two were easy, boilerplate answers. She sent surveys and got 100s on both. One of them sent her a survey in return. She answered it and was done in 90 seconds. The next few queries were more complicated, but she kept her rating at 100. The 6 was more complicated still, but she answered it, got a 98, followed up, and brought it to 100. The client, a heating air conditioning advertiser from Melbourne, Australia, asked if he could add her to his professional network, and she readily agreed. That's when he realized she was May. "The May?" he typed. His name was Edward.
"Can't deny it," she answered.
"I'm honored," Edward typed. "What time is it there? We're just finishing our work day here."
She said it was late. He asked if he could add her to his mailing list, and again she readily agreed. What followed was a quick deluge of news and information about the insurance world of Melbourne. He offered to make her an honorary member of the MHAPB, the Melbourne Heating and Air Conditioning Providers Guild, formerly the Melbourne Heating and Air Conditioning Providers Brotherhood, and she said she would be flattered. He added her to the friends on his personal circle profile and asked that she reciprocate. She did.
"Gotta get back to work now," she wrote. "Say hello to all in Melbourne."
She felt already all of the madness of her parents, of Mercer, evaporating like mist. She took the next query, which came from a pet grooming chain based in Atlanta. She got a 99, followed up, got back 100, and sent 6 other surveys, 5 of which the client answered. She took another query, this one from Bangalore, and was in the middle of amending the boilerplate to the query when another message came through from Edward.
"Did you see my daughter's request?"
he asked. May checked her screens, looking for some request from Edward's daughter. Eventually, he clarified that his daughter had a different last name and was in school in New Mexico. She was raising awareness of the plight of bison in the state and was asking May to sign a petition and mention the campaign in whatever forums she could. May said she would try and quickly sent a zing about it.
"Thank you,"
Edward wrote, followed a few minutes later by a thank you from his daughter, Helena.
"I can't believe May Holland signed my petition. Thanks," she wrote.
May answered 3 more queries, her rating dipping to 98, and though she sent multiple follow-ups to these 3, she got no satisfaction. She knew she'd have to get 22 or so 100s to average the 98 up to 100 overall. She checked the clock. It was 12:44. She had plenty of time. Another message came from Helena, asking about jobs at the Circle. May offered her usual advice and sent her the email address of the HR department.
"Can you put in a good word for me?"
Helena asked. May said she would do as much as she could, given they had never met.
"But you know me pretty well by now,"
Helena said, and then directed her to her own profile page. She encouraged May to read her essays about wildlife preservation and the essay she used to get into college, which she said was still relevant. May said she would try to read them when she could. Wildlife in New Mexico brought Mercer to mind. That self-righteous waste. Where was that man who made love to her on the edge of the Grand Canyon? They had both been so comfortably lost then, when he picked her up from college and they drove through the Southwest with no schedule, no itinerary, never with any idea of where they'd stay that night. They passed through New Mexico in a blizzard, and then to Arizona, where they parked and found a cliff overlooking the canyon with no fences, and there, under a noonday sun, he undressed her, a 4,000-foot drop behind her. He held her, and she had no doubts because he was strong then. He was young then. He had vision then. Now he was old and acted older. She looked up the profile page she'd set up for him and found it blank. She made an inquiry to tech and found he'd been trying to take it down. She sent him a zing and got no answer. She looked up his business page, but it had been taken down too. There was only a message saying he was now running an analog-only business. Another message came through from Helena.
"What did you think?"
May told her she hadn't had time to read anything yet, and the next message was from Edward, Helena's father.
"It sure would mean a lot if you were to recommend Helena for a job there at the Circle. No pressure, but we're counting on you."
May told them, again, that she'd do her best. A notice came through her second screen about a Circle campaign to eradicate smallpox in West Africa. She signed her name, sent a smile, pledged $50, and sent a zing about it. She saw immediately that Helena and Edward re-zinged the message.
"We're doing our part,"
Edward wrote.
"Quid pro quo?"
It was 1:11 when the blackness swept through her. Her mouth tasted acidic. She closed her eyes and saw the tear, now filled with light. She opened her eyes again. She took a swallow of water, but it only seemed to heighten her panic. She checked her watchers. There were only 23,010, but she didn't want to show them her eyes, fearing they would betray her anxiety. She closed them again, which she felt would seem natural enough for a minute, after so many hours in front of the screen. "Just resting the eyes," she typed and sent. But when she closed them again, she saw the tear, clearer now, louder now. What was the sound she was hearing? It was a scream muffled by fathomless waters, that high-pitched scream of a million drowned voices. She opened her eyes. She called her parents. No answer. She wrote to them. Nothing. She called Annie. No answer. She wrote to her. Nothing. She looked her up in the circle search. But she wasn't on campus. She went to Annie's profile page, scrolled through a few hundred photos, most of them from her Europe-China trip, and, feeling her eyes burn, she closed them again. And again she saw the rip, the light trying to get through, the underwater screams. She opened her eyes. Another message came through from Edward.
May, you out there? Sure would be nice to know if you could help out. Do right back.
Could Mercer really disappear like this? She was determined to find him. She searched for him, for messages he might have sent to others. Nothing. She called him, but his number had been disconnected. Such an aggressive move, to change your number and leave no new one. What had she seen in him? His disgusting fat back, those terrible patches of hair on his shoulders. Jesus, where was he? There was something very wrong when you couldn't find someone you were trying to find. It was 1:32.
May? Edward again. Can you reassure Helena that you'll look at her site sometime soon? She's a bit upset now. Just any word of encouragement would be helpful. I know you're a good person, and wouldn't intentionally mess with her head, you know, promising to help and then ignoring her. Cheers! Edward!
May went to Helena's site, read one of the essays, congratulated her, told her it was brilliant, and sent on a zing telling everyone that Helena from Melbourne/New Mexico was a voice to be reckoned with, and that they should support her work in any way they could. But the rip was still open inside May, and she needed to close it. Not knowing what else to do, she activated circle surveys and nodded to begin.
Are you a regular user of conditioner?
Yes, she said.
Thank you. What do you think about organic hair products?
Already she felt calmer.
Smile. Thank you. What do you think about non-organic hair products?
Frown, May said. The rhythm felt right.
Thank you. If your favorite hair care product isn't available at your usual store or online site, would you substitute it for a similar brand?
No.
Thank you.
The steady completion of tasks felt right. May checked her bracelet, which showed hundreds of new smiles. There was something refreshing, the comments were asserting, about seeing a circle semi-celebrity like herself contributing to the data pool like this. She was hearing also from customers she'd helped in her CE days. Customers from Columbus, Johannesburg, and Brisbane all said hello and congratulations. The owner of a marketing firm in Ontario thanked her via Zing for her good example, for her goodwill, and May briefly corresponded, asking how business was up and over there. She answered three more queries and was able to get all three customers to fill out extended surveys. The pod rating was 95, which she hoped she could personally help bring up. She was feeling very good and needed.
May?
The sound of her name, spoken by her processed voice, was jarring. She felt like she hadn't heard this voice in months, but it hadn't lost its power. She knew she should nod, but she wanted to hear it again, so she waited.
May?
It felt like home. May knew, intellectually, that the only reason she was in Frances's room was that everyone else in her life had, for the time being, abandoned her. After 90 minutes at CE, she checked the circle search to see where Francis was and saw he was in one of the dorms. Then she saw he was awake and online. Minutes later, he'd invited her over, so grateful and so happy, he said, to be hearing from her.
I'm sorry, he wrote, and I'll say that again when you get to my door.
She turned off her camera and went to him. The door opened.
I'm so sorry, he said.
Stop,
May said. She stepped in and closed the door.
You want anything?
He asked.
Water? There's this new vodka, too, that was here when I got back tonight. We can try it.
No thanks, she said, and sat on a credenza against the wall. Francis had set up his portables there.
Oh, wait, don't sit there, he said.
She stood up. I didn't sit on your devices.
No, it's not that, he said. It's a credenza. They told me it's fragile, he said, smiling. Sure you don't want a drink or anything?
No, I'm really tired. I just didn't want to be alone.
Listen, he said. I know I should have asked your permission first. I know this. But I hope you can understand where I was coming from. I couldn't believe I was with you, and there was some part of me that assumed it would be the only time. I wanted to remember it.
May knew the power she had over him, and that power gave her a distinct thrill. She sat on the bed.
So did you find them? She asked.
How do you mean?
Last I saw you, you were planning to scan those photos, the ones from your album?
Oh, yeah. I guess I haven't talked to you since then. I did scan them. The whole thing was easy.
So you found who they were?
Most of them had Circle accounts, so I could just face wreck them. I mean, it took about 7 minutes. There were a few I had to use the Fed's database for. We don't have total access yet, but we can see DMV photos. That's most of the adults in the country.
And did you contact them?
Not yet.
But you know where they're all from?
Yeah. Once I knew their names, I could find all their addresses. Some had moved a few times, but I could cross-reference with the years I might have been with them. I actually did this whole timeline of when I might have been at each place. Most of them were in Kentucky, a few in Missouri, one was in Tennessee.
So that's it?
Well, I don't know. A couple are dead, so I don't know. I might just drive by some of these houses just to fill in some gaps. I don't know.
Oh, he said, turning over, brightening.
I did have a couple revelations. I mean, most of the stuff was standard memories of these people, but there was one family who had an older girl. She was about 15 when I was 12. I didn't remember much, but I know she was my first serious sexual fantasy.
Those words, sexual fantasy, had an immediate effect on May. In the past, whenever they'd been uttered with or by any man, it led to the discussion of fantasies and some degree of enacting one or another fantasy, which she and Francis did, even if briefly. His fantasy was to leave the room and knock on the door, pretending to be a lost teenager knocking on the door of a beautiful suburban house. Her job was to be a lonely housewife and invite him in, scantily clad and desperate for company. And so he knocked, and she greeted him at the door, and he told her he was lost, and she told him he should get out of those old clothes, that he could put on some of her husband's. Francis liked that so much that things accelerated quickly, and in seconds he was undressed and she was on top of him. He lay beneath her for a minute or two, letting May rise and fall, looking up at her with the wonderment of a boy at the zoo. Then his eyes closed, and he went into paroxysms, emitting a brief squeal before grunting his arrival. Now, as Francis brushed his teeth, May, exhausted and feeling not love but something close to contentment, arranged herself under the thick comforter and faced the wall. The clock said 3:11. Francis emerged from the bathroom.
I have a second fantasy,
he said, pulling the blanket over him and bringing his face close to May's neck.
I'm inches from sleep, she muttered.
No, nothing strenuous, no activity required. This is just a verbal thing.
Okay.
I want you to rate me, he said.
What?
Just a rating, like you do at CE.
Like from 1 to 100?
Exactly.
Rate what? Your performance?
Yes.
Come on, I don't want to do that. It's just for fun. Francis, please, I don't want to. It takes the enjoyment out of it for me.
Francis sat up with a loud sigh.
Well, not knowing takes the enjoyment out of it for me.
Not knowing what?
How I did.
How you did? You did fine.
Francis made a loud sound of disgust. She turned over.
What's the matter?
Fine? He said. I'm fine?
Oh, God. You're great. You're perfect. When I say fine, I just mean that you couldn't do better.
Okay, he said, moving closer to her. Then why didn't you say that before?
I thought I did.
You think fine is the same as perfect and couldn't do better?
No, I know it's not. I'm just tired. I should have been more precise.
A self-satisfied smile overtook Francis's face.
You know, you just proved my point.
What point?
We just argued about all this, about the words you used and what they meant. We didn't understand their meaning the same way, and we went around and around about it. But if you had just used a number, I would have understood right away.
He kissed her shoulder.
Okay, I get it, she said, and closed her eyes.
Well?
He said. She opened her eyes to Francis's pleading mouth.
Well, what?
You're still not going to give me a number?
You really want a number?
May? Of course I do.
Okay, 100.
She turned to the wall again.
That's a number?
It is. You get a perfect 100.
May felt like she could hear him, grinning.
Thank you,
he said, and kissed the back of her head.
Night.
The room was grand, on the top floor of the Victorian era, with its epic views, its glass ceiling. May entered and was greeted by most of the gang of 40, the group of innovators who routinely assessed and greenlighted new Circle ventures.
Hello, May,
said a voice, and she found its source, Eamon Bailey, arriving and taking his place at the other end of the long room. Wearing a zippered sweatshirt, his sleeves rolled above his elbows, he entered theatrically and waved to her, and, she knew, to all those who might be watching. She expected the audience to be large, given she and the Circle had been zinging about it for days. She checked her bracelet, and the current viewership was 1,982,992. Incredible, she thought, and it would climb. She sat in the middle of the table, better to grant the viewers access not just to Bailey, but to most of the gang, their comments and reactions. After she'd sat, and after it was too late to move, May realized she didn't know where Annie was. She scanned the 40 faces in front of her, on the table's opposite side, and didn't see her. She craned her neck around, careful to keep the camera trained on Bailey, and finally caught sight of Annie by the door, behind two rows of circlers, those standing by the door, in case they needed to leave unnoticed. May knew Annie had seen her, but she made no acknowledgment.
Okay, Bailey said, smiling broadly at the room. I think we should just dig in, given we're all present.
And here his eyes stopped ever so briefly on May and the camera around her neck. It was important, May had been told, that the entire event seemed natural, and that it appeared that May and the audience were being invited into a very regular sort of event.
Hi, gang, Bailey said. Pun intended.
The 40 men and women smiled.
Okay, a few months ago we all met Olivia Santos, a very courageous and visionary legislator who was bringing transparency to a new, and I dare say, ultimate level. And you might have seen that as of today, over 20,000 other leaders and legislators around the world have followed her lead and have taken the pledge to make their lives as public servants completely transparent. We've been very encouraged by this.
May checked the view on her wrist. Her camera was trained on Bailey and the screen behind him. Comments were already coming in, thanking her and the Circle for this kind of access. One watcher compared it to watching the Manhattan Project. Another mentioned Edison's Menlo Park lab, circa 1879. Bailey continued.
Now, this new era of transparency dovetails with some other ideas I have about democracy and the role that technology can play in making it complete. And I use the word complete on purpose, because our work toward transparency might actually achieve a fully accountable government. As you've seen, the governor of Arizona has had her entire staff go transparent, which is the next step. In a few cases, even with a clear elected official, we've seen some corruption behind the scenes. The transparent elected have been used as figureheads, shielding the back room from view. But that will change soon, I believe. The officials and their entire offices with nothing to hide will go transparent within the year, at least in this country. And Tom and I have seen to it that they get a steep discount on the necessary hardware and server capacity to make it happen.
The 40 clapped heartily.
But that's only half the battle. That's the elected half of things. But what about the other half? Our half as citizens. The half where we're all supposed to participate.
Behind Bailey, a picture of an empty polling place appeared in a desolate high school gym somewhere. It dissolved into an array of numbers.
Here are the numbers of participants in the last elections. As you can see, at the national level, we're at around 58% of those eligible to vote. Incredible, isn't it? And then you go down the line to state and local elections, and the percentages drop off a cliff. 32% for state elections, 22% for counties, 17% for most small-town elections. How illogical is that? That the closer government is to home, the less we care about it. It's absurd, don't you think?
May checked her watchers. There were over 2 million. She was adding about 1,000 viewers a second.
Okay, Bailey continued. So we know there are a bunch of ways that technology, much of it originating here, has helped make it easier to vote. We're building on a history of trying to increase access and ease. Back in my day, there was the Motor Voter Bill. That helped. Then some states allowed you to register or update your registration online. Fine. But how did it impact voter turnout?
Not enough.
But here's where it gets interesting. Here's how many people voted in the last national election.
The screen behind him read 140 million.
Here's how many were eligible to vote.
The screen read 244 million.
Meanwhile, there's us. Here's how many Americans are registered with the Circle.
The screen read 241 million.
That's some startling math, right? 100 million more people are registered with us than voted for the president. What does that tell you?
We're awesome!
An older man with a gray ponytail and a frayed T-shirt yelled from the second row. Laughter opened up the room.
Well, sure, Bailey said. But besides that,
it tells you that the Circle has a knack for getting people to participate.
And there are a lot of people in Washington who agree. There are people in D.C. who see us as the solution to making this a fully participatory democracy.
Behind Bailey, the familiar image of Uncle Sam pointing appeared. Then another image of Bailey wearing the same outfit in the same pose appeared next to Uncle Sam. The room guffawed.
So now we get to the meat of today's session. And that is, what if your Circle profile automatically registered you to vote?
Bailey swept his eyes across the room, hesitating again at May and her watchers. She checked her wrist. Goosebumps, one viewer wrote.
With True You, to set up a profile, you have to be a real person, with a real address, complete personal info, a real Social Security number, a real and verifiable date of birth. In other words, all the information the government traditionally wants when you register to vote. In fact, as you all know, we have far more information. So why wouldn't this be enough information to allow you to register? Or better yet, why wouldn't the government, our government, or any government, just consider you registered once you set up a True You profile?
The 40 heads in the room nodded, some out of acknowledgement of a sensible idea, some clearly having thought of this before, that it was a notion long discussed.
May checked her bracelet. The viewer numbers were climbing quicker, 10,000 a second, and were now over 2,400,000. She had 1,248 messages. Most had come through in the last 90 seconds. Bailey glanced down at his own tablet, no doubt seeing the same numbers she was seeing. Smiling, he continued.
There's no reason. And a lot of legislators agree with me. Congresswoman Santos does, for one, and I have verbal commitments from 181 other members of Congress and 32 senators. They've all agreed to push legislation to make your True You profile your automatic path to registration. Not bad, right? There was a brief round of applause.
Now think, Bailey said, his voice a whisper of hope and wonder. Think if we can get closer to full participation in all elections. There would be no more grumbling from the sidelines from people who had neglected to participate. There would be no more candidates who had been elected by a fringe, wedge group. As we know here at the Circle, with full participation comes full knowledge. We know what circlers want because we ask, and because they know their answers are necessary to get a full and accurate picture of the desires of the whole Circle community. So, if we observe the same model nationally, electorally, then we can get very close, I think, to 100% participation, 100% democracy.
Applause rippled through the room. Bailey smiled broadly, and Stenton stood. It was, for him at least, apparently the end of the presentation. But an idea had been forming within May's mind, and she raised her hand tentatively.
"Yes, May?"
Bailey said, his face still locked into a broad grin of triumph.
"Well, I wonder if we couldn't take this one step further. I mean, well, actually, I don't think it—"
"No, no, go on, May. You started well. I like the words, one step further. That's how this company was built."
May looked around the room, the faces a mix of encouraging and concerned. Then she alighted on Annie's face, and because it was stern and dissatisfied and seemed to be expecting, or wanting, May to fail, to embarrass herself, May gathered herself, took a breath, and forged ahead.
"Okay, well, you were saying we could get close to 100% participation, and I wonder why we couldn't just work backwards from that goal, using all the steps you outlined, all the tools we already have."
May looked around the room, ready to quit at the first pair of skeptical eyes, but she saw only curiosity, the slow collective nodding of a group practiced in preemptive validation.
"Go on," Bailey said.
"I'm just going to connect some dots," May said. "Well, first of all, we all agree that we'd like 100% participation and that everyone would agree that 100% participation is the ideal."
"Yes," Bailey said. "It's certainly the idealist's ideal."
"And we currently have 83% of the voting-age Americans registered on the circle?"
"Yes."
"And it seems that we're on our way to voters being able to register and maybe even to actually vote through the circle."
Bailey's head was bobbing side to side, some indication of mild doubt, but he was smiling, his eyes encouraging. "A small leap, but okay, go on."
"So why not require every voting-age citizen to have a circle account?"
There was some shuffling in the room, some intake of breath, mostly from the older circlers. "Let her finish," someone, a new voice, said.
May looked around to find Stenton near the door. His arms were crossed, his eyes staring at the floor. He looked briefly up to May and nodded brusquely. She regained her direction.
"Okay, I know the initial reaction will be resistance. I mean, how can we require anyone to use our services? But we have to remember that there are all kinds of things that are mandatory for citizens of this country, and these things are mandatory in most industrialized countries. Do you have to send your kids to school?"
"Yes, that's mandatory. It's a law. Kids have to go to school, or you have to arrange some kind of homeschooling, but it's mandatory. It's also mandatory that you register for the draft, right? That you get rid of your garbage in an acceptable way. You can't drop it on the street. You have to have a license if you want to drive, and when you do, you have to wear a seatbelt."
Stenton joined in again.
"We require people to pay taxes and to pay into Social Security, to serve on juries."
"Right," May said. "And to pee indoors, not on the streets. I mean, we have 10,000 laws. We require so many legitimate things of citizens of the United States. So why can't we require them to vote? They do in dozens of countries."
"It's been proposed here,"
one of the older circlers said.
"Not by us," Stenton countered.
"And that's my point,"
May said, nodding to Stenton.
"The technology has never been there before. I mean, at any other moment in history, it would have been prohibitively expensive to track down everyone and register them to vote, and then to make sure they actually did. You'd have to go door to door, drive people to polls, all these unfeasible things. Even in the countries where it's mandatory, it's not really enforced. But now it's within reach. I mean, you cross-reference any voting rolls with the names in our TrueU database, and you'd find half the missing voters right there and then. You register them automatically, and then when election day comes around, you make sure they vote."
"How do we do that?" a female voice said. May realized it was Annie's. It wasn't a direct challenge, but the tone wasn't friendly either.
"Oh, geez," Bailey said. "100 ways. That's an easy part. You remind them 10 times that day. Maybe their accounts don't work that day till they vote. That's what I'd favor anyway. Hello, Annie," it could say. "Take 5 minutes to vote." Whatever it is, we do that for our own surveys. You know that, Annie.
And when he said her name,
He shaded it with disappointment and warning, discouraging her from opening her mouth again. He brightened and turned back to May.
"And the stragglers?"
he asked. May smiled at him. She had an answer. She looked at her bracelet. There were now 7,202,821 people watching. When had that happened?
"Well, everyone has to pay taxes, right? How many people do it online now? Last year, maybe 80%. What if we all stopped duplicating services and made it all part of one unified system? You use your Circle account to pay taxes, to register to vote, to pay your parking tickets, to do anything. I mean, we would save each user hundreds of hours of inconvenience, and collectively, the country would save billions."
"Hundreds of billions," Stenton amended.
"Right," May said. "Our interfaces are infinitely easier to use than, say, the patchwork of DMV sites around the country. What if you could renew your license through us? What if every government service could be facilitated through our network? People would leap at the chance. Instead of visiting 100 different sites for 100 different government services, it could all be done through the Circle."
Annie opened her mouth again. May knew it was a mistake.
"But why wouldn't the government," Annie asked, "just build a similar wraparound service? Why do they need us?"
May couldn't decide if she was asking this rhetorically or if she truly felt this was a valid point. In any case, much of the room was now snickering. "The government building a system from scratch to rival the Circle?" May looked to Bailey and to Stenton. Stenton smiled, raised his chin, and decided to take this one himself.
"Well, Annie, a government project to build a similar platform from the ground up would be ludicrous and costly, and, well, impossible. We already have the infrastructure and 83% of the electorate. Does that make sense to you?"
Annie nodded, her eyes showing fear and regret and maybe even some quickly fading defiance. Stenton's tone was dismissive, and May hoped he would soften when he continued.
"Now more than ever," he said, but now more condescending than before. "Washington is trying to save money and is disinclined to build vast new bureaucracies from scratch. Right now, it costs the government about $10 to facilitate every vote. 200 million people vote, and it costs the feds $20 billion to run the presidential election every 4 years, just to process the votes for that one election, that one day. You factor in every state and local election, we're talking hundreds of billions every year in unnecessary costs associated with simple vote processing. I mean, they're still doing it on paper in some states. If we provide these services for free, we're saving the government billions of dollars, and more importantly, the results would be known simultaneously."
"Do you see the truth in that?"
Annie nodded grimly, and Stenton looked to her as if assessing her anew. He turned to May, urging her to continue.
"And if it's mandatory to have a TrueU account to pay taxes or receive any government service," she said, "then we're very close to having 100% of the citizenry, and then we can take the temperature of everyone at any time. A small town wants everyone to vote on a local ordinance. TrueU knows everyone's address, so only residents of that town can vote. And when they do, the results are known in minutes. A state wants to see how everyone feels about a new tax. Same thing. Instant and clear and verifiable data."
"It would eliminate the guesswork," Stenton said, now standing at the head of the table. "Eliminate lobbyists, eliminate polls, it might even eliminate Congress. If we can know the will of the people at any time, without filter, without misinterpretation or bastardization, wouldn't it eliminate much of Washington?"
The night was cold, and the winds were lacerating, but May didn't notice. Everything felt good, clean, and right. To have the validation of the wise men, to have perhaps pivoted the entire company in a new direction, to have perhaps, perhaps, ensured a new level of participatory democracy? Could it be that the Circle, with her new idea, might really perfect democracy? Could she have conceived the solution to a 1,000-year-old problem? There had been some concern just after the meeting about a private company taking over a very public act, like voting. But the logic of it, the savings inherent, was winning the day. What if the schools had $200 billion?
What if the healthcare system had $200 billion? Any number of the country's ills would be addressed or solved with that kind of savings. Savings not just every 4 years, but some semblance of them every year. To eliminate all costly elections replaced by instantaneous ones, all of them nearly cost-free? This was the promise of the Circle. This was the unique position of the Circle. This is what people were zinging. She read the zings as she rode with Francis in a train under the bay, the two of them grinning out of their minds. They were being recognized. People were stepping in front of May to get onto her video feed, and she didn't care. Hardly noticed, because the news coming through her right bracelet was too good to take her eyes off. She checked her left arm, briefly. Her pulse was elevated, her heart rate at 130, but she was loving it. When they arrived downtown, they took the stairs three at a time and arrived above ground, suddenly lit in gold on Market Street, the Bay Bridge blinking beyond.
Holy shit, it's May!
Who had said that? May found, hurrying toward them, a teenaged pair, hoodies and headphones.
Rock on, May, the other one said, their eyes approving, starstruck, before the two of them, clearly not wanting to seem stalky, hurried down the stairs.
That was fun,
Francis said, watching them descend. May walked toward the water. She thought of Mercer and saw him as a shadow, quickly disappearing. She hadn't heard from him, or Annie, since the talk, and she didn't care. Her parents hadn't said a word and might not have seen her performance, and she found herself unconcerned. She cared only about this moment, this night, the sky clear and starless.
I can't believe how poised you were,
Francis said, and he kissed her, a dry, professional kiss on the lips. Was I okay? She asked, knowing how ridiculous it sounded, this kind of doubt in the wake of such an obvious success, but wanting once more to hear that she had done a good job.
You were perfect, he said. A 100.
Quickly, as they walked toward the water, she scrolled through the most popular recent comments. There seemed to be one particular zing with heat, something about how all this could or would lead to totalitarianism. Her stomach sank.
Come on, you can't listen to a lunatic like that, Francis said. What does she know? Some crank somewhere with a tinfoil hat?
May smiled, not knowing what the tinfoil hat reference meant, but knowing she'd heard her father say it, and it made her smile to think of him saying it.
Let's get a libation,
Francis said, and they decided on a glittering brewery on the water fronted by a wide outdoor patio. Even as they approached, May saw recognition in the eyes of the array of pretty young people drinking outdoors.
It's May, one said.
A young man, seeming too young to be drinking at all, aimed his face at May's camera.
Hey, Mom, I'm home studying.
A woman of about 30, who may or may not have been with the two young men, said, walking out of view,
Hey, honey, I'm at a book club with the ladies. Say hi to the kids.
The night was dizzy and bright and went too fast. May barely moved at the Bayside bar. She was surrounded. She was handed drinks. She was patted on the back. She was tapped on the shoulder. All night she pivoted, turning a few degrees like a haywire clock to greet each new well-wisher. Everyone wanted a picture with her, wanted to ask her when all this would happen. When would we break through all these unnecessary barriers, they asked. Now that the solution seemed clear and easy enough to execute, no one wanted to wait. A woman a bit older than May, slurring and holding a Manhattan, expressed it best, though unwittingly. How, she asked, spilling her drink, but with eyes sharp.
How do we get the inevitable sooner?
May and Francis found themselves at a quieter place down the Embarcadero, where they ordered another round and found themselves joined by a man in his 50s. Uninvited, he sat down with them, holding a large drink in both hands. In seconds, he'd told them he was once a divinity student, was living in Ohio and heading for the priesthood, when he discovered computers. He'd dropped it all and moved to Palo Alto, but had felt removed for 20 years, he said, from the spiritual.
Until now.
I saw your talk today, he said. You connected it all. You found a way to save all the souls. This is what we were doing in the church. We tried to get them all. How to save them all? This has been the work of missionaries for millennia.
He was slurring, but took another long swallow from his drink.
You and yours at the Circle?
and here he drew a circle in the air, horizontally, and May thought of a halo.
You're going to save all the souls. You're going to get everyone in one place. You're going to teach them all the same things. There can be one morality, one set of rules. Imagine.
And here he slammed his open palm upon the iron table, rattling his glass.
Now all humans will have the eyes of God. You know this passage. All things are naked and opened unto the eyes of God.
Something like that. You know your Bible? Seeing the blank looks on the faces of May and Francis, he scoffed and took a long pull from his drink.
Now we're all God. Every one of us will soon be able to see and cast judgment upon every other. We'll see what he sees. We'll articulate his judgment. We'll channel his wrath and deliver his forgiveness on a constant and global level. All religion has been waiting for this. When every human is a direct and immediate messenger of God's will... Do you see what I'm saying?
May looked at Francis, who was having little success holding back a laugh. He burst first, and she followed, and they cackled, trying to apologize to him, holding their hands up, begging his forgiveness. But he was having none of it. He stepped away from the table, then swirled back to get his drink, and, now complete, he rambled crookedly down the waterfront. May awoke next to Francis. It was 7 a.m. They passed out in her dorm room shortly after 2. She checked her phone, finding 322 new messages. As she was holding it, her eyes bleary, it rang. The caller ID was blocked, and she knew it could only be Calden. She let it go to voicemail. He called a dozen more times throughout the morning. He called while Francis got up, kissed her, and returned to his own room. He called while she was in the shower, while she was dressing. She brushed her hair, adjusted her bracelets, and lifted the lens over her head, and he called again. She ignored the call and opened her messages. There was an array of congratulatory threads from inside and outside the circle, the most intriguing of which was spurred by Bailey himself, who alerted May that circle developers had begun to act on her ideas already. They'd been working through the night in a fever of inspiration, and within a week hoped to prototype a version of May's notions to be used first in the circle, polished there, and later rolled out for use in any nation where circle membership was strong enough to make it practical.
"We're calling it Democracy," Bailey zinged. "It's democracy with your voice and your moxie, and it's coming soon."
That morning, May was invited to the developer's pod, where she found 20 or so exhausted but inspired engineers and designers who apparently already had a beta version of Democracy ready. When May entered, cheers erupted, the lights dimmed, and a single light shone on a woman with long black hair and a face of barely contained joy.
"Hello, May. Hello, May's watchers," she said, bowing briefly. "My name is Sharma. And I'm so glad and so honored to be with you today. Today, we'll be demonstrating the very earliest form of democracy. Normally, we wouldn't move so quickly and so, well, transparently, but given the circle's fervent belief in democracy and our confidence that it will be adopted quickly and globally, we couldn't see any reason to delay."
The wall screen came to life. The word democracy appeared, rendered in a spirited font and set inside a blue and white striped flag. "The goal is to make sure that everyone who works at the circle can weigh in on issues that affect their lives, mostly on campus, but in the larger world, too. So throughout any given day, when the circle needs to take the company's temperature on any given issue, circlers will get a pop-up notice, and they'll be asked to answer the question or questions. The expected turnaround will be speedy and will be essential. And because we care so much about everyone's input, your other messaging systems will freeze temporarily until you answer. Let me show you." On the screen, below the Democracy logo, the question, "Should we have more veggie options at lunch?" was bookended by buttons on either side. Yes and no. May nodded.
"Very impressive, guys."
"Thank you," Sharma said. "Now, if you'll indulge us, you have to answer, too."
And she invited May to touch either yes or no on the screen.
"Oh,"
May said. She walked up to the screen and pushed yes. The engineers cheered. The developers cheered. On the screen, a happy face appeared, with the words, "You are heard," arcing above.
The question disappeared, replaced by the words, Democracy result. 75% of respondents want more veggie options. More veggie options will be provided.
Sharma was beaming.
See? That's a simulated result, of course. We don't have everyone on Democracy yet, but you get the gist. The question appears, everyone stops briefly what they're doing, responds, and instantly the circle can take appropriate action knowing the full and complete will of the people. Incredible, right?
It is, May said.
Imagine this rolled out nationwide, worldwide.
It's beyond my capability to imagine.
But you came up with this,
Sharma said. May didn't know what to say. Had she invented this? She wasn't sure. She'd connected a few dots, the efficiency and utility of the circle surveys, the constant circle goal of total saturation, the universal hope for a real and unfiltered, and most crucially, complete democracy. Now it was in the hands of the developers, hundreds of them, at the circle, the best in the world. May told them this, that she was just one person who connected a few ideas that stood inches apart, and Sharma and her team beamed and shook her hand, and they all agreed that what had already been done was setting the circle, and possibly all of humanity, on a significant new path. May left the Renaissance and was greeted, just outside the door, by a group of young circlers, all of whom wanted to tell her, all of them on their tiptoes, bursting, that they had never voted before, that they had been utterly uninterested in politics, had felt disconnected entirely from their government, feeling they had no real voice. They told her that by the time their vote, or their name on some petition, was filtered through their local government, and then their state officials, and finally their representatives in Washington, it felt like sending a message in a bottle across a vast and troubled sea. But now, the young circler said, they felt involved. If democracy worked, they said, then laughed. When democracy is implemented, of course it will work, they said. And when it does, you'll finally have a fully engaged populace. And when you do, the country and the world will hear from the youth, and their inherent idealism and progressivism will upend the planet. This is what May heard all day. As she wandered through the campus, she could barely get from one building to another without being accosted. We're on the verge of actual change, they said. Change at the speed that our hearts demand. But throughout the morning, the calls from the blocked number continued. She knew it was Calden, and she knew she wanted no part of him. Talking to him, much less seeing him, would be a significant step back now. By noon, Sharma and her team announced that they were ready for the first actual all-campus democracy tryout. At 12:45, everyone would receive 5 questions, and the results would not only be tabulated immediately, but, the wise men promised, the will of the people would be enacted within the day. May was standing in the center of the campus, amid a few hundred circlers eating lunch, all of them buzzing about the imminent democracy demonstration, and she thought of that painting of the Constitutional Convention, all those men in powdered wigs and waistcoats standing stiffly, all of them wealthy white men who were only passably interested in representing their fellow humans. They were purveyors of an innately flawed kind of democracy, where only the wealthy were elected, where their voices were heard loudest, where they passed their seats in Congress to whatever similarly entitled person they deemed appropriate. There had been some incremental improvements in the system since then, maybe, but democracy would explode it all. Democracy was purer, was the only chance at direct democracy the world had ever known. It was 12:30. And because May was feeling strong and feeling so confident, she finally succumbed and answered her phone, knowing it would be Calden. Hello, she said.
May, he said, his voice terse. This is Calden. Don't say my name. I've rigged it so the incoming audio isn't working.
No.
May, please, this is life or death.
Calden held a power over her that shamed her. It made her feel weak and pliable. In every other facet of her life, she was in control, but his voice alone dissembled her and opened her to an array of bad decisions. A minute later, she was in the stall, her audio was off, and her phone rang again.
I'm sure someone is tracing this, she said. No one is. I bought us time.
Calden, what do you want?
You can't do this. Your mandatory thing and the positive reaction it's gotten, this is the last step toward closing the circle, and that can't happen.
What are you talking about?
This is the whole point. If you've been here so long, you know more than anyone that that's been the goal of the circle since the beginning. I mean, it's a circle, stupid. It has to close. It has to be complete.
May, all along, for me at least, this kind of thing was the fear, not the goal. Once it's mandatory to have an account, and once all government services are channeled through the circle, you'll have helped create the world's first tyrannical monopoly.
Does it seem like a good idea to you that a private company would control the flow of all information? That participation, at their beck and call, is mandatory?
You know what Ty said, right?
May heard a loud sigh.
Maybe. What did he say?
He said the soul of the circle is democratic, that until everyone has equal access, and that access is free, no one is free. It's on at least a few tiles around campus.
May, fine, the circle's good, and whoever invented True You is some kind of evil genius. But now, it has to be reined in, or broken up.
Why do you care? If you don't like it, why don't you leave? I know you're some spy for some other company, or Williamson, some loony anarchist politician.
May, this is it. You know this affects everyone. When were you last able to meaningfully contact your parents? Obviously, things are messed up, and you're in a unique position to influence very crucial historical events here. This is it. This is the moment where history pivots. Imagine if you could have been there before Hitler became chancellor, before Stalin annexed Eastern Europe. We're on the verge of having another very hungry, very evil empire on our hands, May. Do you understand?
Do you know how crazy you sound?
May? I know you're doing that big Plankton meeting in a couple days, the one where the kids pitch their ideas, hoping the circle buys them and devours them.
So?
The audience will be big. We need to reach the young, and the Plankton pitching is when your watchers will be young and vast. It's perfect. The wise men will be there. I need you to take that opportunity to warn everyone. I need you to say, let's think about what closing the circle means.
You mean completing?
Same thing. What it means for personal liberties, for the freedom to move, do whatever one wants to do, to be free.
You're a lunatic. I can't believe I...
May meant to finish that sentence with, slept with you, but now, even the thought of it seemed sick.
May, no entity should have the power those guys have.
I'm hanging up.
May, think about it. They'll write songs about you.
She hung up. By the time she made it to the Great Hall, it was raucous with a few thousand circlers. The rest of the campus had been asked to stay at their workspaces to demonstrate to the world how democracy would work across the whole company, with circlers voting from their desks, from their tablets and phones, and even retinally. On the screen in the great room, a vast grid of sea change cameras showed circlers at the ready in every corner of every building. Sharma had explained, in one of a series of zings, that once the democracy questions were sent, each circler's ability to do anything else, any zing, any keystroke, would be suspended until they voted.
Democracy is mandatory here,
she said, and added, much to May's delight, sharing is caring. May planned to vote on her wrist and had promised her watchers that she would take into account their input too if they were quick enough. The voting, Sharma suggested, shouldn't take longer than 60 seconds. And then the democracy logo appeared on the screen, and the first question arrived below it. 1. Should the circle offer more veggie options at lunch? The crowd in the Great Hall laughed. Sharma's team had chosen to start with the question they'd been testing. May checked her wrist, seeing that a few hundred watchers had sent smiles, and so she chose that option and pushed send. She looked up to the screen, watching circlers vote, and within 11 seconds, the whole campus had done so, and the results were tabulated. 88% of the campus wanted more veggie options at lunch. A zing came through from Bailey. It shall be done. The Great Hall shook with applause. The next question appeared. 2. Should take your daughter to work day happen twice a year instead of just once? The answer was known within 12 seconds. 45% said yes. Bailey zinged, looks like once is enough for now. The demonstration so far was a clear success, and May was basking in the congratulations of circlers in the room and on her wrist and from watchers worldwide. The third question appeared, and the room broke up with laughter. 3. John or Paul or Ringo? The answer, which took 16 seconds, provoked a riot of surprised cheers.
Ringo had won, with 64% of the vote. John and Paul were nearly tied at 20 and 16. The fourth question was preceded by a sober instruction. Imagine the White House wanted the unfiltered opinion of its constituents, and imagine you had the direct and immediate ability to influence U.S. foreign policy. Take your time on this one. There might come a day, there should come a day, when all Americans are heard in such matters. The instructions disappeared, and the question arrived. 4. Intelligence agencies have located terrorist mastermind Muhammad Khalil Ahmed in a lightly populated area of rural Pakistan. Should we send a drone to kill him, considering the likelihood of moderate collateral damage? May caught her breath. She knew this was a demonstration only, but the power felt real. And it felt right. Why wouldn't the wisdom of 300 million Americans be taken into account when making a decision that affected them all? May paused, thinking, weighing the pros and cons. The circlers in the room seemed to be taking the responsibility as seriously as May. How many lives would be saved by killing Al-Hamed? It could be thousands, and the world would be rid of an evil man. The risk seemed worth it. She voted yes. The full tally arrived after 1 minute, 11 seconds. 71% of circlers favored a drone strike. A hush fell over the room. Then the last question appeared. 5. Is May Holland awesome or what? May laughed, and the room laughed, and May blushed, thinking this was all a bit much. She decided she couldn't vote on this one, given how absurd it would be to cast a vote either way, and she simply watched her wrist, which she soon realized had been frozen. Soon the question on her wrist screen was blinking urgently. All circlers must vote, the screen said, and she remembered that the survey couldn't be complete until every circler had registered their opinion. Because she felt silly calling herself awesome, she pushed frown, guessing it would be the only one, and would get a laugh. But when the votes were tallied, seconds later, she was not the only one to have sent a frown. The vote was 97% to 3, smiles to frowns, indicating that, overwhelmingly, her fellow circlers found her awesome. When the numbers appeared, the great room erupted in whoops, and she was patted on the back as everyone filed out, feeling the experiment a monumental success. And May felt this way, too. She knew Democracy was working, and its potential unlimited, and she knew she should feel good about 97% of the campus finding her awesome, but as she left the hall and made her way across campus, she could only think of the 3% who did not find her awesome. She did the math. If there were now 12,318 circlers, they just subsumed a Philadelphia startup specializing in the gamification of affordable housing, and every one of them had voted, that meant that 369 people had frowned at her, thought she was something other than awesome. No, 368. She'd frowned at herself, assuming she'd be the only one. She felt numb. She felt naked. She walked through the health club, glancing at the bodies sweating, stepping on and off machines, and she wondered who among them had frowned at her. 368 people loathed her? She was devastated. She left the health club and looked for a quiet place to collect her thoughts. She made her way to the rooftop near her old pod where Dan had first told her of the circle's commitment to community. It was a half-mile walk from where she was, and she wasn't sure she could make it. She was being stabbed. She had been stabbed. Who were these people? What had she done to them? They didn't know her, or did they? And what kind of community members would send a frown to someone like May, who was working tirelessly with them, for them, in full view? She was trying to hold it together. She smiled when she passed fellow circlers. She accepted their congratulations and gratitude, each time wondering which of them was two-faced, which of them had pushed that frown button, each push of that button the pull of a trigger. That was it, she realized. She felt full of holes, as if every one of them had shot her from behind, cowards filling her with holes. She could barely stand. And then, just before reaching her old building, she saw Annie. They hadn't had a natural interaction in months, but immediately something in Annie's face spoke of light and happiness. "Hey," she said, catapulting herself forward to take May in a wraparound hug. May's eyes were suddenly wet, and she wiped them, feeling silly and elated and confused. All her conflicted thoughts of Annie were, for a moment, washed away. "You're doing well?" she asked.
I am. So many good things happening, Annie said. Did you hear about the Past Perfect project?
May sensed something in Annie's voice then, an indication that Annie was talking, primarily, to the audience around May's neck. May went along.
Well, you told me the gist before. What's new with Past Perfect, Annie?
While looking at Annie and appearing interested in what Annie was saying, May's mind was elsewhere. Had Annie frowned at her? Maybe just to knock her down a notch? And how would Annie fare in a democracy poll? Could she beat 97%? Could anyone?
Oh, gosh, so many things, May. As you know, Past Perfect has been in the works for many years. It's what you might call a passion project of Eamon Bailey. What if, he thought, we use the power of the web and of the circle and its billions of members to try to fill in the gaps in personal history and history generally?
May, seeing her friend trying so hard, could do nothing but try to match her glossy enthusiasm.
Whoa, that sounds incredible. Last we talked, they were looking for a pioneer to be the first to have their ancestry mapped. Did they find that person? Well, they did, May. I'm glad you asked. They found that person, and that person is me.
Oh, right. So they really didn't choose yet?
No, really,
Annie said, her voice lowering and suddenly sounding more like the actual Annie. Then she brightened again, rising an octave.
It's me!
May had become practiced in waiting before speaking. Transparency had taught her to measure every word. And now, instead of saying, I expected it to be some newbie, someone without a whole lot of experience, or at the very least a striver, someone trying to make some party rank leaps or curry favor with the wise men, but you? She realized that Annie was, or felt she was, in a position where she needed a boost, an edge, and thus she'd volunteered.
You volunteered?
I did, Annie said, looking at May, but utterly through her.
The more I heard about it, the more I wanted to be the first. As you know, but your watchers might not, my family came here on the Mayflower,
and here she rolled her eyes,
and though we have some high water marks in our family history, there's so much I don't know.
May was speechless. Annie had gone haywire.
And everyone's on board with this? Your parents? They're so excited. I guess they've always been proud of our heritage and the ability to share it with people, and along the way find out a bit about the history of the country. Well, it appealed to them. Speaking of parents, how are yours?
My God, this was strange, May thought. There were so many layers to all this, and while her mind was counting them, mapping them, and naming them, her face and mouth had to carry on this conversation.
They're fine, May said, even though she knew, and Annie knew, that May hadn't been in touch with them in weeks.
They had sent word through a cousin of their health, which was fine, but they had left their home, fleeing was the only word they used in their brief message, telling May not to worry about anything. May wrapped up the conversation with Annie and walked slowly, foggy-headed, back through campus, knowing Annie was satisfied in how she'd communicated her news and trumped and thoroughly confused May, all in one brief encounter. Annie had been appointed the center of Past Perfect, and May hadn't been told, and was made to look idiotic. Certainly, that would have been Annie's goal. And why Annie? It didn't make sense to go to Annie when it would have been easier to have May do it. May was already transparent. May realized that Annie had